Thank you. Please be seated.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Calling the first case of Winters versus 8th Judicial District Court, case number 75292. We have both parties present. What I'd ask you to do is to please give your name to my clerk when you appear, and if you do have any parties or anyone you want to introduce like co-counsel, please do so as well for the record. And appellant, how much rebuttal time, if any, would you like?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. That will be the order. Thank you. You can proceed.
Good afternoon. Eunice Beattie from the law firm of Scrow & Roger on behalf of petitioners Avis Winters and Dan Winters. May it please the court. The issue in this case is whether the district court abused its discretion by awarding attorney's fees to a non-prevailing party. It was a motion filed entitled Defendant's Motion for Terminating Sanctions or in the alternative to disqualify the law offices of Patty Scrow & Rogers. As I go through the argument of why the award of attorney's fees was an error, I would like to explain some of the procedural history of this case.
Well, before we get to the actual merits of it, isn't the first question, this isn't a direct appeal, this is a writ petition. So what about this case can't be appealed in the normal course of things after a verdict?
So what occurred was after the attorney's fees were awarded, the respondent moved to enforce the award of attorney's fees against our clients and started the process to obtain the judgment.
But that occurs in every single time the district court awards attorney's fees to a party. That can be said in every case, that the fees have to be turned over. That's still an adequate remedy at law. So why writ this? Why should we intervene as an extraordinary remedy?
Well, in this case, we believe that not only did the district court abuse its discretion by awarding attorney's fees, but the conduct complained of is an alleged ethical violation as to petitioner's counsel, but the actual award itself is penalizing the client, the petitioners, for conduct that's allegedly an ethical violation of their attorney and not conduct that they themselves participated in.
Well, let me ask you this. Are you aware that the Supreme Court just issued an opinion on August, I believe, 27th on Valley Health? And I'll ask counsel that on the other side as well. Are you familiar with that case that just came down from the Supreme Court?
I am not, Your Honor.
You're not?
I'm not.
Okay. Well, it just came down from the Supreme Court, and basically it was an award of attorneys, it was a sanction against attorneys. It's Valley Help versus Jane Doe. And I'll be asking Mr. Schoenfeld as well as he's writing it down. It's a consolidated appeal, and the other part was a writ. And it was Hall and Prangle versus 8th Judicial, Judge Scotty. In that case, Judge Scotty had sanctioned the law firm for discovery violations and actually within the order mentioned that the attorneys violated the rules of professional conduct. And that opinion just came down from the Supreme Court. And I wanted to see, and I'll ask the other side to distinguish it, but if you're not familiar with it, they upheld the sanction and the fact that the district court did state that the attorneys violated professional ethics.
And so the client.
And they struck the answer. It was case concluding sanctions against Valley Hospital. Actually, it was Centennial Hospital. It was Valley Health Systems, leaving only damages. So it was almost case-concluding sanctions. And they upheld that in that case. I'm sorry to take you off that. I suppose we could have asked for supplemental briefing, but it was exactly on this issue. Go ahead and continue then. I didn't mean to take you off your argument.
Well, would you like me to proceed with
yes, go
the
ahead.
Procedural aspect of it? Okay. So the winners filed their complaint on August 31st, 2015, alleging the respondent murdered their daughter. There's only one claim for relief in the complaint, and that is a claim for forfeiture. The rationale being that under the Nevada Slayer statute, the respondent should not be able to profit from his wrongdoing. On November 26, 2016, the respondent filed a motion to terminate the case or disqualify counsel due to numerous complaints, which motion is the underlying subject of this hearing. In May of 2017, the district court denied the motion. The district court did find a violation of 3.6A, essentially for Mr. Skro speaking to the media about the case in approximately September 2016. Despite making the findings, the district court failed to articulate any basis or support for its findings. The court noted that the appropriate remedy was with the Nevada State Bar. There was no mention of a sanction in this original order. However, the language of the order stated, notwithstanding the requested relief that has been denied, in light of the court findings, counsel is awarded attorney's fees for preparation of the motion, review of the opposition, preparation of the reply, and arguing the motion. Defendant's counsel shall file a separate motion outlining the specific request for fees. So in response to your earlier question, while I am not familiar with the Valley Health case, one argument I would make is that this was not originally a sanction in the original order. It was stated as an award for attorney's fees. There was no mention ever of any type of sanction. It was not until, so thereafter, Mr. Schoenfeld requested $19,800 for an estimated 36 hours of work at $550 an hour. What's interesting about that request was that in his affidavit, he admitted this case was taken as a flat fee, and it did not contemplate having to file the motion at issue or motions like this at issue. So what he did was he said he didn't have a billable rate, but he estimated that his average was between $450 and $650 an hour, depending on the complexity of the case. So for this case, he decided it would be $550 an hour. And so he requested $19,800 for this award. So what happened was the winners opposed the request. They cited some case law, such as Logan, 350 P3D 1139 in 2015, arguing he did not provide invoices, records supporting his time, and moreover, he was not the prevailing party. Because the order was unclear, there was no mention of a sanction. It said that it was an award of attorney's fees, and for the first time in the order, it actually stated that the Winters themselves were responsible for the attorney's fees, whereas the original order made no such distinction.
So let me ask you this.
Sure.
You know, it's a little bit of an unusual basis for fees because she's basing it on a violation of an ethical rule rather than an actual violation of, say, Rule 11 or some other statute. Now, the reason that you don't see this much is because frequently an ethical rule won't have anything to do with a particular case. For example, if I'm embezzling money from a client's trust fund, that's a clear ethical violation, but it doesn't actually affect anything that happens in any particular case in a courtroom, right? But in this case, the district court and, you know, the whole procedure that you're going through, the ethical violations here, you can make a pretty strong argument, had a real impact on a court case. So why, even though this is an unusual situation, why is it wrong for the district court to do that?
So the argument by the law firm would be, one, that there was no ethical violation. Two, there were no findings in support of an ethical violation in the actual original order. If you look at the actual original order, it's very vague. It's very short. It's very simple. It's that the motion is denied. It's that there is a finding of an ethical violation. It references Mr. Skro speaking to the media about the case, but that's where it stops short. Then it says, oh, the penalty being asked for is too high. The appropriate remedy is with the Nevada State Bar. But notwithstanding that, and notwithstanding the fact that this motion is denied, Mr. Schoenfeld can receive attorney's fees for the work done. If you want to get into the underlying basis of the actual ethical violation, it's 3.6. It is a two-prong analysis. The first is that there was dissemination of material, which we're not necessarily disputing. But the second part of it,
Wasn't Mr. Skro offered an evidentiary hearing by the district court and he refused it? I mean, if you refuse an evidentiary hearing, then the court, district court only has what the district court has, which is the arguments before it. Didn't he refuse an evidentiary hearing on that issue? That's what real party in interest has alleged in their briefs.
I am not clear on whether there was an actual refusal, but what I am aware of is that Mr. Gentile was brought into the case because of the argument that there was no actual violation of 3-6, and the prong that it turned on was that the dissemination would have a substantial likelihood of materially prejudicing an adjudicated proceeding. A case that was actually cited was the Gentile versus State Bar of Nevada case, where the U.S. Supreme Court said the timing of the dissemination is a significant factor in whether there is going to be prejudice. And in the Gentile case, the fact that the statement was made 6 months prior to trial, the U.S. Supreme Court said it would not result in prejudice because the content of the disclosure would have faded from memory long before the trial date. In this case, the alleged statements were made in September of 2016. We still don't have a trial date. Our case has stayed. It's been over 2 years, and we don't know if this case will ever go to trial. So the
but our standard on review on attorney's fees, even on appeal, is abuse of discretion. And so how did the district court abuse its discretion then? If it found that there were, that there were violations of the rules of professional conduct, albeit the evidentiary hearing was turned down. I know I read that somewhere. Oops. Am I not watching? Oh, that's 5 minutes. Go ahead and finish. I'll give you more time.
Thank you. The original court order did not state it was a sanction. The original court order specifically stated that any ethical violation could be handled by the Nevada State Bar, but because of the work performed in writing the motion, that counsel should get his attorney's fees. It was an attorney's fees award.
Well, the original order is not very good. But there was the order after the reconsideration. So the judge appeared to try to fill the gaps. Maybe not every gap, but tried to fill the gaps. So if we turn to that order, where do we stand then?
That order, the court cites to several statutes and cases, doesn't really apply the analysis to these specific facts to those statutes and cases, but if you were to look at them, the first one is NRS 18.0102, which is an award for the prevailing party.
Right.
Our argument
is... That doesn't make much sense at all, so let's move on past that.
Correct. The next statute, EDCR 7.60 is the next thing cited, and that is when an attorney without just cause presents an opposition which is obviously frivolous, unnecessary, or unwarranted. In this case, we are the ones who filed the opposition because we were threatened to have our case dismissed or to be disqualified. So the argument is it was not a frivolous opposition.
How about the next part of the rule?
Sure. The next part is a case that was cited, which was Emerson. The language in Emerson is that the district court has broad discretion to impose sanctions for professional misconduct at trial. That is word for word what that case says. And
that's what happened in Emerson, though. The Supreme Court didn't actually limit it to trial only. That just happened to be the factual underpinning of that case.
So both in Emerson and Young, which was the case cited in Emerson, there basically the parties fabricated evidence in discovery. So the sanctions were based also on an NRCP 37 violation. It wasn't just... So what happened in one case was that the conduct necessitated an entire new trial, and I did want to bring this up. Because a whole entire new trial was necessitated and the expert had to be basically paid again, the attorney said that for the cost of the trial, for him to prepare the whole entire trial and for to pay the expert, it was $19,300. And because of the conduct of this attorney in fabricating evidence, that was awarded. In this case, he's asking for even more. He's asking for $19,800 for basically one motion hearing that was argued. But that case, what it says is that it has to be proportional. The sanction has to be proportional to the conduct. And that's what I would argue. The cases cited by the court in support of its order is not proportional to what occurred here.
I'll give you more time. I'm going to give you one more minute on the clock, so you'll have three more. I'm sorry about that, but Judge Gibbons asked some questions there at the end, so I'll give you another minute.
Okay, thank you.
We just got started on our argument. We never got to the second part of it.
Well, you should have asked the question sooner.
and the last case
Do you want to use all of your time, or do you want 3 minutes for rebuttal?
I will use one more minute right now and then
okay.
For rebuttal. The last case cited by the court was Frenzel. Obviously, I'm not disputing Mr. Schoenfeld's qualities or character of the work done, but the work actually performed skill, time, attention given to the work. He did not obtain the relief sought, did not support the request of the $19,800 or the $2,750 for the motion for reconsideration with any substantial evidence. There were no billing records, invoices, et cetera. There was not an explanation of the finding of the Rule of Professional Conduct 3.6 violation, which I already spoke of. And again, the acts complained of occurred over 2 years ago without a trial anywhere in sight in the civil case. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from the real party in interest.
Thank you. May it please the Honorable Court, Richard Schoenfeld, appearing along with real party in interest, Gregory Brent Dennis. I'm going to start off where Judge Tao started, which is that writ relief is not appropriate in this instance.
Wait, are you familiar with the Valley Health case? Because it just came, are you familiar with that?
I'm not.
Because one of the things that the Supreme Court said is, quote, we have consistently held that an appeal is generally an adequate legal remedy precluding writ relief. However, sanctioned attorneys do not have standing to appeal because they are not parties in the underlying action. Therefore, extraordinary writs are proper avenues. So how would you distinguish what we're talking about as far as the writ
here's how
versus appeal?
Distinguish it. The Emerson case and the Watson versus Rounds case are no different than what Your Honor just stated. In those cases, the attorney was sanctioned with an award of attorney's fees. Because the attorney is not a party to the case, at the conclusion, they can't appeal.
How would the Winters have known what this, or explain to me how the district court distinguished that the party, like in Valley Health, the employees knew about the prior sexual assaults and they didn't disclose it in discovery. How did the Winters know or control what the attorneys were going to do in this case or their publicists?
And I'll respond in two answers to that. First, that was not an issue raised in the district court, so that issue becomes waived on appeal. Second, the Winters were complicit in the improper conduct in this case. What the district court found in its order that starts at 402 of the appellant's appendix or petitioner's appendix is that they hired a public relations company. The Winters were interviewed. Mr. Scrow was interviewed. They put together a video that they posted on Facebook that had 39,000 views that said such things as, he would have gotten away with it. Had captions, Brent Dennis, a licensed psychologist, stood there and watched her die. Had Mr. Scrow in another interview saying, when you look at what Brent Dennis told the police, we know very quickly that he lied to the police. They were complicit in that conduct, but unfortunately the district court found that it didn't rise to the level to terminate the case and also found that disqualifying counsel would be too harsh of a sanction, even though the court found that there was an extensive, I'm quoting, extensive record of the Rule 3.6 violation in this case.
So let me ask you this, going back to the issue of whether writ relief is appropriate, and I'm going to play with the facts a little bit. Hypothetically, let's say a district court finds an ethical violation and sanctions both you and your client. Your client can appeal after the trial, but you can't. Or are you saying there's some mechanism where you can? So you just have to. So if you can't file for relief on your own behalf, when would you ever?
Well, and it's interesting in this case because you don't find anywhere in this writ Mr. Scrow challenging the Rule 3.6a violation finding. Nowhere. The only thing being challenged is the award of attorney's fees, which was a sanction under the inherent authority of the district court against the Winters, which was a prevailing party award under NRS 18.010 subsection 2B, and which was also a prevailing party or a deterrent for abusive litigation practices under District Court Rule 7.60. Every aspect of what the court is being asked to review in this case is an award against the parties. None of it has to do with the findings against Mr. Scrow. And so when we go back and we look at the Emerson case and we look at the Watson Round case where the court granted writ relief and reviewed awards of attorney's fees in the middle of the trial or in the middle of the proceedings in an interlocutory fashion, those were awards against the attorney. The attorney cannot appeal at the conclusion of the case after a final judgment. In this case, the award is against the Winters. They never challenged the fact that the award was against the Winters. They don't even challenge in this writ that the award should have been granted against Mr. Scrow and not the Winters. Never raised. So what we have is an issue that at the conclusion of the district court proceedings, when a judgment is entered, it can be appealed. And what I would note, based on, I haven't read the Valley case, but it's interesting. If I wanted to challenge this order saying that the district court should have terminated the case or should have disqualified Mr. Scrow, that would be something I'd have to raise at the conclusion of the judgment, because that would be a direct appeal issue. And this is a direct appeal issue. So it is not ripe for writ relief. We look at the consolidated generator case versus Cummins, where it says interlocutory orders are best suited for appeal after a judgment has been entered in the case,
Mr. Schoenfeld, let's assume you're right about that for the moment. And this case goes on to the next phase, and there's an order to show cause entered and a contempt hearing held and an order to pay the fees. And what do? Then they just have to pay the fees, and then at the end of the case, maybe years from now, ask whom to return the fees if they win.
And respectfully, Your Honor, that is what would have to occur. It's no different than when someone receives a judgment at the conclusion of a trial in a civil case. They can take it up on appeal, but absent posting a bond, the parties get to collect on that judgment. If the case gets reversed, then it has to be addressed when the case is reversed. So while it may not be ideal, that is the state of the law, and that's the law that we have to follow. There isn't a single case that talks about a party being granted writ relief, interlocutory, relative to an award of attorney's fees. Lawyers, yes. Parties, no. And when we look at the basis upon which the court entered it, let's start with the inherent authority aspect of it. And before I get there, obviously the court's aware of Rule 3.6, but to be clear, it is an abusive litigation practice. It is a lawyer making an extrajudicial statement of non-public information that will be disseminated to the public that has a substantial likelihood of materially prejudicing the judicial or adjudicative process.
I know I read somewhere, I'm assuming it had to be your reporting interest brief, that the petitioners refused an evidentiary hearing. Would you happen to have the exact place in the record on appeal on that?
403 is the district court's order, petitioner's appendix, 403, where the court made the finding that they offered Mr. Scrow and Mr. Gentile the opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing, and they refused.
And
I was there. It did happen.
All right.
But that's in the district court order, and that would also be in the transcript, but I don't have the page for that. But that is the citation to the order where the district court made that finding. So when we look at what the court had in front of it and the findings that it made in reference to the Rule 3.6a violation, we can see how egregious it was. And what the court found was, stated that there was no question that a violation of 3.6a had occurred, that plaintiff's counsel hired a PR firm to disseminate unpublished discovery material and material that was governed by a protective order. That's also at page 402 of the record. That plaintiff's counsel was repeatedly interviewed by the media, and that there was no purpose other than to materially prejudice the adjudicative process. No purpose for his interviews except to do that. That the plaintiffs hired the PR firm to post the Facebook videos that were created for the sole purpose of disseminating this prejudicial material that was non-public, and that counsel for the plaintiffs disclosed to the media a 49-page investigative report, which was at one point in time they asserted a work product privilege over it, but then they handed it over to the media. A 49-page report which included statements of counsel, statements of their investigators to the media, which was then disseminated publicly. And the court expressly found that the extrajudicial statements did materially prejudice the case and that confidential and non-public information was disclosed. So again, the court found an extensive record.
How did the district court find prejudice if the case hasn't gone to trial?
Well, the district court didn't believe that we had to go to trial in order to find that prejudice, but the court found, after reviewing the article after article, the Facebook videos where they claimed that my client lied to the police, where they had a table with fake cocaine on it to suggest that my client was doing drugs while his wife died, statements they made in the video, the court found that it is impossible not to believe that there was prejudice as a result of it.
How does it prejudice a trial that's not been set? I mean, you explain it to me.
Well,
I mean, these can all be terrible things, and you can call somebody every name in the book, but if the trial hasn't been set, and it's not as if you try to pick a jury and you couldn't pick a jury, how do you show the prejudice?
here's what I would respond to that, Your Honor. Number one, the statute or the rule doesn't require a finding of prejudice. It requires a finding of a likelihood that it would materially prejudice. And that's what the court found. The court may have gone further by stating that it actually did prejudice my client, but I really don't think that's too much of a leap of faith given the extensive and egregious nature of the 3.6a violation.
So just to clarify, the prejudice here that you're talking about is trial prejudice. Is there any discovery prejudice, or is it just the trial prejudice, jurors being poisoned, that kind of thing that you're worried about?
Trial prejudice would be the ultimate concern, but obviously disseminating videotaped depositions that were governed by a protective order is quite troubling. But I don't believe that that would have harmed future discovery. I mean, it's possible when we went to take other witnesses' depositions, if they've seen every deposition in the case because they've been publicly disseminated in contravention of a protective order, I could see that causing the prejudice. So then we get to, under Emerson versus 8th Judicial District Court, citing Young versus Ribeiro, the petitioner claims here that the court only has inherent authority to remedy a trial abuse, and that's just not the case. While in that case, as Judge Gibbons noted, it was a trial case, the court did not limit it to those circumstances. To the contrary, what the court specifically said in Young is that litigants and attorneys alike should be aware that these powers may permit sanctions for discovery and other litigation abuses not prescribed by statute. So obviously a discovery abuse isn't limited to trial. And when they say other litigation abuses, that's not limited to a trial. So there's just nothing actually in a case that suggests it's limited to a trial when you're dealing with inherent authority. And it's no different than the U.S. Supreme Court in Roadway versus Piper, where they recognize the federal courts have the inherent authority to address discovery abuses and impose sanctions on litigation abuses.
Does it matter that in the original court order, Judge Bell didn't really make any findings on this or characterize it as sanctions?
And I'm going to answer with no, and the reason for that is found in Arnold versus Kipp. And what the court said in Arnold versus Kipp is that here the district court's order denying reconsideration was entered before the Arnold's notice of appeal from the final judgment was filed, and so the reconsideration motion and order are properly part of the record on appeal. So we have here the court's clarification as a result of the reconsideration that is properly before the court. So the court is not limited to the original order. So respectfully, it doesn't matter that the first order was not as detailed as the second one.
Well, so even in the second order, the judge identified inherent authority and the statute and the 8th Judicial District Court rule, but didn't really explain the nexus. The court just identified, here's the authority, therefore I can do it. Did not explain it.
Well, the inherent
does that matter?
It doesn't, respectfully. The inherent authority is clear that the inherent authority exists to remedy discovery abuses, and therefore it's a sanction. And the court did say that in the order on reconsideration, that it was a sanction imposed. As a result, the only question becomes, is it grossly disproportionate to the conduct? It's not what the petitioner said. It's not the burden that the court has to make it proportionate. It just cannot be grossly disproportionate to the conduct. So to award me 36 hours of attorney's fees at a rate that the court found reasonable cannot be grossly disproportionate to the discovery violations and all of the extensive findings of the Rule 3.6a violation. But I'm going to jump ahead because I'm running out of time. Even under the Brunzell analysis, it's clear that the court is not supposed to substitute the judgment of the district court when assessing the value placed on attorney services. But nevertheless, the affidavit that I submitted in support of the Brunzell analysis outlined my background, qualifications, the work that was performed.
Have you seen Judge Gibbons' opinion on Wynn versus O'Connell?
I have not, Your Honor.
Okay, and the O'Connell case.
Well, let him ask you about it.
Really quickly, because you are short on time.
Just came down.
It came out on August 30th, and this court held that billing statements don't have to be submitted to support a contingency fee request. That was in an offer of judgment context. So here, there were no billing statements submitted. You said you had this on a flat fee.
Correct.
I think you also said the other side should describe what their fees are, too.
I invited them to take me up on that opportunity to show that my fees were unreasonable.
Well, that would be good, but we're missing what the flat fee was. So where do these fees go to, assuming that Judge Bell enforces this order?
What the fees go to is that when I was hired, it wasn't contemplated that I would have to address an egregious violation of Rule 3.6A with the media smear campaign of non-public information that Mr. Scrow went on. So it couldn't even have been contemplated. So he, as a result, when you look at 7.60, cause multiplied the proceedings in a case to increase the costs unreasonably. That's precisely what occurred here. But for that 3.6A violation, I wouldn't have had to spend 36 hours addressing it. And so, therefore, the order under 7.60B is appropriate, well, that, also under Brunzell.
That looks like it happened, but what about the word "and vexatiously," which is also in the rule?
Well, I mean, I would submit that it's vexatious, but I don't know that the court actually made that finding. Clearly, the court found that it was unreasonable based on the, okay, you know,
so
extensive findings.
You started with the inherent authority. Do you think that's the best way to look at this?
I think inherent authority is the strongest aspect of the order. I think under 18.0102B, there's also some strength because it's read to be, or it's supposed to be applied very liberally, and it's supposed to cause checks and balances for discovery abuses. So I think it would be appropriate here, but the petitioner claims that's only appropriate in claims, cross-claims, counterclaims. But if you look at subsection 3, it also refers to awards being entered at the conclusion of a special proceeding. I would submit that given the petitioners were entitled to an evidentiary hearing and rejected it, and we had an extensive hearing, that that could constitute a special proceeding, and therefore the award would be appropriate under 18.010 subsection 2B as well.
Thank you, Mr. Sean.
Thank you.
All right, we'll hear back from the petitioner. Ms. Beattie.
Thank you. So I apologize, but I am learning about the Valley case as this hearing is going on. And my response to what I heard asked of Mr. Schoenfeld would be that the writ relief is appropriate because if you look at the motion, the order denying the motion for reconsideration, every finding is essentially directed against Mr. Scrow. Counsel Scrow directly participated in the media statements. The court therefore found that Mr. Scrow made extrajudicial statements that materially prejudiced the case and that he caused confidential and non-public material to be disclosed. Mr. Scrow has acknowledged that he provided the report to the media. And so all of these ethical violations are being argued against Mr. Scrow. Accordingly, this court has ample authority and basis to
the petition's bound in the name of Avis and Dan Winters, not in Mr. Scrow's name. Right, and so the relief you're asking for isn't actually directed to Mr. Scrow, it's directed to the Winters, correct?
Correct.
And this is a new argument.
Yes, the conduct that is being complained of is all Mr. Scrow's conduct in, you know, in accordance with this order. So the argument would be that writ relief is appropriate in this action because it is the conduct of the counsel that is being challenged. The Winters themselves...
It's the attorney's fees against the parties that's being...
Correct.
...truly at issue.
The Winters did not commit an attorney ethical violation. The Winters are not charged with knowing what the ethical violations of the Nevada State Bar would be.
How do you respond to their allegations that it was the Winters' Facebook and the Winters were completely in on this? Because that's really what Valley Health says, is the party, like the hospital, is going to take the fall or the blame when, even if there's an attorney, you know, violation. How do you respond to that? That the Winters were in on this.
So my argument
as far as the ethical violation.
My argument would be that for every paragraph that discusses the alleged factual violation, it's Mr. Scrow's name. It's not plaintiffs or Mr. Scrow. It's that Mr. Scrow made these statements. Mr. Scrow directly participated. The Winters are not charged with the knowledge at the end of every paragraph of this order.
How about the argument of Mr. Schoenfeld that we should look at inherent authority and look at the reconsideration motion in order and let's overlook the deficiencies that occurred before that? Go ahead.
Okay. My recollection of that case was that it was actually cited to discuss why any arguments we made in the writ were not valid, and because they were not raised in the original motion practice. That's where Arnold and Kipp was cited to in their answer, and our reply addressed that argument. It's the first time I'm hearing facts pertaining to why we should ignore the original order and concentrate on the motion for reconsideration. It is fully briefed in the reply, that case, and the argument for why it was brought forth, but it was not in relation to that argument.
Thank you.